You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Next weekend, the Globalization Trilogy will show at the Van City Theatre. Mika Peled's documentaries put a human face on complex issues resulting from global economic forces. The trilogy aims to generate debate about public policy and consumer choices regarding these issues. The first film, Store Wars, When Walmart Comes to Town, focuses on consumerism in the U.S. China Blue investigates the sweatshop labor conditions in the manufacturing of the clothes we all buy. The last film in the series is Bitter Seeds. It looks at the crisis of the farmers in India who are growing the cotton exported to China's garment factories to be used for the clothes sold in the West. Director Mika X. Peled will be in Vancouver to introduce the film. He joins me this morning from California. Hello, Mika.
Good morning, Jane.
Now, tell me why you decided to make a trilogy.
Well, first I should say that I didn't know when I started out that I would be making a trilogy. It was more a serendipitous process where one film led into the next, and before I knew it, I had a trilogy. But I think, you know, the trilogy is called Globalization Trilogy, and I think that topic is so vast and so rich that it certainly bears probably, you know, you could make 100 trilogies in it, and they will each bring us some new aspect of it. So there's a lot to explore there.
Now, the first film in the series looked at a conflict in a small town in Virginia over a proposal by Walmart to open a big box store there. What kind of dynamics emerged in the community in response to that situation?
So the reason I realized that there was a good film to make there is not only because it's an important topic, but because I found out right away that when Walmart wants to come into a town, it immediately divides the population between those who oppose it and those who support it. And that divide and the debate between the two, and I realize, will enable us to explore this issue. But on the one hand, we have people who want cheap goods and want jobs, even if they are low-paying jobs. And on the other hand, we have people who are concerned about the quality of life in their community, and other values that are more middle class as opposed to working class values. That debate, that conflict, enabled me to have drama in the film kind of built in. And so I traveled to quite a lot of towns looking for the perfect town for where to make the film. It was sort of like casting for a town rather than for characters. And I ended up in a town called Ashland, Virginia, where I was able to arrive at the beginning of the conflict. So the entire year-long conflict about whether we should allow Walmart to come here or not unfolded in front of the camera. It enabled me to really explore this issue of what these big box stores are doing to small-town life. And the really extreme value that our society puts on consumerism. It seems like, you know, cheap prices trump anything else.
Well, did you talk to Walmart as a part of that process?
Yes, absolutely. In all my films, I make every possible effort to bring the, let's call it the bad guy into the film. The big corporation that the film will criticize, because it's very important to hear their side of it and also to humanize them. By the way, this is becoming more and more impossible because major corporations over the years have learned to refuse any requests from independent media, any kind of media that they cannot control. So that nowadays they just say no to any requests. But this was 12 years ago, and everybody was still a little bit more innocent, and I was able to get Walmart's cooperation. And so in the film, we see not only what happens inside a major shareholder meeting of Walmart, which is the largest shareholder meeting in the world, But we follow one of their executives whose job it is to go to small towns and sweet talk them into allowing zoning changes so that Walmart can come in. And we certainly get their point of view very clearly.
So you said at the outset that you didn't set out to make a trilogy. So at what point in the process did you decide that you needed to go one step more back towards the source?
Yeah, so, you know, Jane, my projects, I always think of them as both a film and a website, even then 13 years ago, because in my films I focus on narrative arc on characters. We follow a few people. I try to put a human face on the issue. But the website is where you can get a lot more information and data and context. And so when we created the website for the film Star Wars When Walmart Comes to Town, and this was done through PBS in the United States, we put there just as an example of where the cheap goods at Walmart sells us, where they get made and how they get made. And that example was of a handbag factory in China. And that got me thinking that it actually would be interesting to follow that thread. But for quite a while, I couldn't see the film in it. All I could think of is that we will film, you know, hundreds of people hunched over sewing machines, and they're miserable all day. So where's the story? Where's the film? And only when I got the idea of focusing on one girl that has to leave the village to get a job, because all the workers in these huge garment factories come from far away, from the hinterland of China, where there are no jobs. 130 million Chinese, in fact, have already migrated. And so we focus on one girl who, from the day that she arrives at the factory, and she's excited about the new opportunity and getting a job and being part of the modern world, and then she descends into sweatshop hell. But also equally important in the film is the role of the owner of the factory, who is a former police chief in the town. And just when we learn to hate him for how he exploits the workers while he's driving a Mercedes and eating in wonderful restaurants, we see a business meeting with a buyer who comes from the UK, who is pressuring him down on the price. $4.25 for a pair of jeans is too much. It's got to be $4 is the top I can pay. And the owner has no choice but to take the contract, but he says the only way I can make a profit is by taking these 25 cents off the workers' pay. It's the only thing that has some flexibility in it. So we see that now the workers get fined for every minute that they're late to work, or they're wearing the wrong shoes, or what have you. And we really get the picture of that kind of a food chain where, you know, everybody exploits the one below them.
Were you able to film inside the factory?
Oh, yeah. Most of the film takes place inside the factory. We also follow one girl back home when she goes on holiday once a year. But the majority of the film is inside one factory. It's a blue jeans factory, and hence the title of the film, China Blue. And that was, I had two huge access challenges in this film, and that was one, and the second one was dealing with the Chinese authorities, because it's not a film that they would have authorized, and you're not allowed to make a film in China without a permit. If you get a permit, that means you have somebody from the propaganda ministry attached to you from the moment you arrive until you leave, and obviously they control what you can film. So we had to go underground, and at the beginning I just took a small camera and pretended to be a tourist. Once I realized that there is a film here to make and I did have the access, I wanted to bring a big camera to have, you know, with a big lens and have good quality cinematography. And so for three times we smuggled the camera into China, took it apart in Hong Kong, and carried it into China and out. So that was one major obstacle. The other one was getting access into a factory, and we knocked on many doors and got turned down many times until I met Mr. Lin, who was the owner of the Blue Jeans factory, and I was introduced to him by a business associate of his from Hong Kong. And I said, Mr. Lin, I want to make a film about the first generation of Chinese entrepreneurs. You guys couldn't go to business school. There wasn't any. But you're hardworking, you take risks, and you create a lot of jobs. But of course, I also want to film your workers, and I need to have complete access 24/7 without management over my shoulder. And he was interested. And, you know, it was a time in China where you still could not really, if you didn't know what's going on in the outside world, you could not envision a television crew who will be making something against the positions of the state, you know, who will be maybe offering a critical alternative view of anything. It was inconceivable in China at the time. So I think that's why he allowed me in. And actually, his factory is better than most that I saw over there. So in his universe, he really had nothing to be ashamed of.
Now, the third of the three films in the trilogy takes us to India. How did you go about telling the story of the people who produce the cotton that goes into the factories that then go to the Walmarts?
Yeah, so with the second film about China, at the very end of the film, over the end credits, somebody comes to the owner of the factory and announces that they just got their first order from Walmart, which connected us to the first film. And so that got me interested in going to the raw materials, the cotton. And I found out that really in every level we have major involvement of multinational corporations, and that always the local poor people are getting exploited and getting the short end of the stick. So I actually was in a film festival where I met Vandana Shiva, who is a well-known Indian scientist and activist, and she told me about the crisis of the farmers that has gotten to such levels that, out of despair, every 30 minutes one farmer in India commits suicide. And that the main reason for that is they can't pay back their debts and they lose their land. And what has changed in recent years is the seeds. They now have only genetically modified seeds available to them on commercial quantities and don't have any other recourse. I'm talking here specifically about the cotton-growing region. And those seeds are just simply not suitable for their conditions in India. It may be suitable in the United States, where you have huge corporate farms. The smallest one in the United States for cotton is 1,200 acres. In India, the protagonist of my film, he has 3 acres and a pair of bulls to plow it, and the cotton gets picked by the hands of him, his wife, and his children. There's no combines or any kind of machinery involved. But they just cannot make a living anymore from the cotton that has provided livelihood for centuries of their ancestors. And the main reason is because this is a very arid area. And with the genetically modified plants, you need to give it a lot of fertilizers and water to get this higher yield. And the farmers there don't have irrigation. 90% of them depend on rain. And when the rain doesn't come, they cannot wet the soil, and therefore they cannot put the fertilizer in it, and so they never get the level of yield that is promised by the GMO plants. And since this operation is so much more expensive than saving your own seeds and using your cow dung for fertilizer and so on, that they end up losing every year.
Now, you traveled on a film tour through villages in India showing the film Bitter Seeds. What kind of reaction did the film get?
Yeah, that one was the most amazing and most heart-wrenching film tour I've ever had. You know, I traveled with this film in a lot of places, from Vancouver to Rio, from Johannesburg to Jerusalem. But going to India was something I could not have imagined, actually. We traveled there were three of us. We traveled with a mobile projector and a wide big white sheet and two poles, and every afternoon we would arrive in a village and set up, and we had a car with a loudspeaker that traveled through the lanes of the village announcing that there would be a screening right after dark, and practically everybody in the village would arrive. We had this huge tarp on the ground, Now, these are people that have never seen a film on the large screen. There are no cinemas anywhere near there. They've never seen a documentary, because what they see on TV is Bollywood. And they certainly have never seen a film about themselves. So that was already quite an amazing anthropological encounter. But mostly we did all this to engage in a dialogue with the farmers. And I did the tour in collaboration with a local farmer organization. And the head of that organization, Kishore Tiwari, who also appears briefly in the film, he would take the microphone after the screening and engage the farmers in a discussion. And at the beginning, we mostly got resignation, people saying, yes, this is the story of our lives. This film could have been made in our village. That's how it is. The only solution is suicide. And then we started challenging them to look for alternatives, saying, well, who are you punishing when you commit suicide, Monsanto or the family that you leave behind? And once the farmers got challenged, they started talking about really wanting the option to go back to conventional seeds, which would dramatically reduce their costs. The pesticide that their grandfathers used was grinding the leaves of the neem tree. It's a unique tree that doesn't grow here. And they didn't even have bank accounts because they didn't need to borrow money. But that option today does not exist because there is no quantity of conventional cotton seeds available at all in India.
What do you hope that international audiences will take away from these films?
I first of all hope that people feel a lot more connected to other people on the other side of the globe that look very different, that speak a different language, that have a very different way of life, usually are a lot poorer. But through the films, connect on a human level with these people, because what we see in these films are very universal needs and dreams. In Bitter Seeds, the other main character is a young woman that hopes to become a journalist, and we see her interviewing her neighbors as she's writing her first article. In China Blue, the young woman who's the protagonist, the worker in the factory, in her spare time, she writes little fiction stories and has a sense of humor and feels like she could have been the girl next door if she were just born on this side of the ocean. So with each one of these films, I try to connect us to the rest of the world and get us to consider a little bit more what is the price that that those people are paying so that we can have a very comfortable life. Because in reality, the cost that we are paying for our clothes is artificially reduced because these corporations are in a position to impose their requirements and their demands on whether it is on the factories or on the workers or the farmers that grow the cotton. I basically want to bring more the human side into the globalization debate, which usually is just about the bottom line.
Well, they really sound like wonderful films. I have all the information about the screenings, which I'm going to let people know about. But I just wanted to thank you very much for talking to me this morning, Mika.
It's been a pleasure, Jane. I look forward to coming to Vancouver next weekend and discussing these issues with the audience.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Mika Peled. He's the director of three films in the Globalization Trilogy. All the films are going to be screened starting next Friday at the Van City Theater. Mika will be here on Sunday to introduce the film and to participate in post-screening forums. So just to give you a little bit more detailed information, Store Wars and China Blue are going to be showing Saturday, Sunday, and Monday afternoons at the Van City Theatre next weekend, so May 18th, 19th, and 20th, 4:30, 4 o'clock, and 3 o'clock. You can check the Van City Theatre schedule for those precise times on that. Bitter Seeds is going to be showing at the Van City Theatre for an entire week starting on Friday. And it's an evening film. Times range from 6:30 to 8:30. And as I said, there's going to be a panel with Mika on Sunday, May 19th at 8:30. Sapora Berman is also going to be there, and Gerardo Otero, and Mika X. Peled, the director of the Globalization Trilogy.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.